announcement that normally my office hours on Thursday are 4 to 5, but I'll do it today also 1 to 2. If you don't get your exam when we return them after class, which reminds me I have to prop the door open for Dr. Chazen, you can come pick it up during those times. Also, if you want to speak to me about exams and improvement and all that, bring your exam with you. Okay. If you want to talk about anything else, that's good too. I noticed on Tuesday I didn't have many customers, being as we had just had an exam. Okay, so what I want to do today is discuss the issue of regulation, at least at the beginning, of regulation of protein synthesis in prokaryotes. We have talked about how to make protein, but today I want to talk about how you control the amount of protein that is produced. And the easiest way to do that, maybe, is to consider what would be reasonable for a bacterial cell to do. Now, let's consider three different enzymes. An enzyme of glycolysis, it doesn't matter which one. A very famous enzyme called beta-galactosidase. Often abbreviated beta-gal. And an enzyme called tryptophan synthetase. Now, you already know what the role of the glycolytic enzyme is. It plays a part in the central pathway of energy metabolism. Now, when do you need this enzyme? Is there a time you can do without? Virtually never, since glucose is the primary energy source for almost all living cells. This is an enzyme that you would think you would need all the time. On the other hand, what about beta-galactosidase? Now, what does this enzyme do? This enzyme catalyzes the first step in the metabolism of lactose. Lactose is the primary sugar found in milk. And it is a dimer of glucose and galactose. Now, in order to use lactose, the first thing you have to do is to hydrolyze this bond. Then the glucose goes into the usual pathway. The galactose, which is an isomer of glucose, is rearranged and then also feeds through the same thing. So you have to be able to split this disaccharide to get anywhere. And beta-galactosidase catalyzes the hydrolysis of lactose and other similar sugars. So it's the first step in a pathway of breakdown for energy purposes. Now, when would you think you would need this enzyme? If you're growing in minimal medium with glucose as the carbon source, do you need this enzyme? No. So when do you need it? When lactose is the primary energy source. If you have to break down lactose, you need this enzyme. So it would be sensible to make this enzyme when? When you have lactose or when you don't? When you do. When you have lactose around and you want to break it down, you need this enzyme. So it makes sense to make it when you have lactose. Now let's consider, by contrast, tryptophan synthetase. What it does is to catalyze the last step in the synthesis of the amino acid tryptophan. So there's a series of reactions, and the last one leads to tryptophan, and tryptophan synthetase catalyzes this reaction. Now, when would you need this enzyme? If they're in minimal medium, do you need this enzyme? Well, metformin has no tryptophan, right? Tryptophan's an amino acid. You got to make it. So if there's no tryptophan, do you need this enzyme? Yes. So you need this enzyme only when tryptophan is absent. So when you are without tryptophan. So it would make sense to make the glycolytic enzymes all the time, beta-galactosidase only when you needed it, only when there's lactose, and tryptophan synthetase only when you need it, only when there's no tryptophan. So the question is that how it works? So let's take a look. You want to look at 15A at the top. Here we have the measure. You can measure the amount of a particular enzyme in a culture, and you can calculate the amount of enzyme per cell, and you can do that with time. Now, suppose you have cells that are growing without lactose. Here we're measuring the amount of beta-galactosidase. Now, suppose you grow the cells and there's no lactose. How much enzyme should there be per cell? Shouldn't be any, and it's very low. It's low to non-existent. But what happens if you add lactose? If you add the sugar now, you find that the enzyme per cell rises until it reaches a plateau value. Now, this means that the cells are making enzyme faster than they're growing. So the amount of enzyme per cell increases. Also, of course, the total enzyme increases as well. But you reach a point at where you have the maximum amount of per cell. Now, the cells are growing and the enzyme per culture is growing, but the amount per cell is constant. What would happen if you took the lactose away or if you used it up? What happens is this. Now, why does it decline so slowly? It turns out the cells stop making enzyme. They stop making beta-galactosidase. But the old beta-galactosidase is still there. So why does the amount per cell drop? Because the cells grow. And they parcel out the same amount of old enzyme among a larger and larger number of cells. So what you're doing here is diluting the amount per cell. In terms of enzyme per culture, what's happening? The total amount of enzyme per culture is staying the same, but the amount per cell is gradually declining. Now, there's a little chart underneath which lists now what's going on. So for the enzyme beta-galactosidase, when you add lactose, enzyme synthesis goes on. And when you take lactose away, enzyme synthesis goes off. So as it says here, when you add the right molecule, which here is lactose, which is called the effector because it has an effect, when you add the sugar lactose, enzyme synthesis starts. And this phenomenon is called induction. Because adding this small molecule has induced the cells to start making enzyme. So this small molecule, the effector, is called an inducer. And synthesis of beta-galactosidase is said to be inducible. Now, that's the situation with beta-galactosidase. What's the situation with tryptophan synthetase? That's our next graph. So instead of measuring beta-galactosidase per cell, this time we measure tryptophan synthetase per cell. With time. Now, if you don't have any tryptophan, what would you expect? High enzyme, low enzyme? No tryptophan, have to make your own neat enzyme. So you have high enzyme. Now what happens if you take tryptophan away? You either use it up or you get rid of it. What happens? Well, I said it the wrong way. What happens if you add tryptophan? Because you didn't have any. So now you add tryptophan. Do the cells need to make their own? No, you get it for free. So the cells stop making new enzyme. But remember, the old enzyme lies around and has to be diluted out. So the enzyme per cell falls gradually. Notice this is the converse. But now, what happens when the tryptophan is either used up or removed? Once you take tryptophan away, the amount of enzyme per cell increases rapidly. So what's going on here? The cells are now making new enzyme because they have to make their own tryptophan. So the cells make enzyme faster than they grow, and the enzyme per cell rises until it reaches the previous level. Now, in this case, the small molecule trigger is not sugar lactose, but the amino acid tryptophan. When you add tryptophan, what happens? Synthesis doesn't start, synthesis stops. Now, this phenomenon is called repression. Because when you add tryptophan, you turn off or repress synthesis of the enzyme. And synthesis of tryptophan synthetase is said to be repressible. So what should you call tryptophan, the small molecule effector? What's the obvious thing to call it? You'd call it the repressor. But by the time they got this far, somebody else had been named the repressor. A protein had been named the repressor already. So instead, this is called the co-repressor, not the repressor. So tryptophan is the co-repressor. Now notice that repression and induction seem to show the same phenomena, but in opposite directions. And as we will see, the mechanism of the two is pretty much the same. And Jacob and Monod got the Nobel Prize for figuring out how they both work, which is by essentially the same mechanism. But just before we leave this, what's with the glycolytic enzymes? They are, in fact, made all the time. So there's no effector here that turns on and off synthesis. Synthesis is the same, doesn't go on or off. And the synthesis is said to be constitutive. Constitutive just means on all the time, not turn offable. And notice that synthesis of this enzyme is supposed to be constitutive. As we will see later, by mutation, you can in fact get the other two to be made constitutively, but that's an abnormal state of affairs. And the analysis of those mutants was used to help figure out the mechanism by which this works. Now, before we go any further and talk about the mechanism, which is what I want to do next, we have to ask, what do you need this for? Have we ever talked before about a way of shutting down a pathway? There's the old feedback inhibition. So maybe you really don't need, why do you need this if you have feedback inhibition? And why do you need that if you have enzyme activation? It doesn't make any sense. So let's look at that more carefully because, in fact, it does make sense. So what I want to do is compare feedback inhibition to repression, because we talked a lot already about inhibition. And these are compared on your handout on the bottom. So let's just draw a little diagram of a standard pathway. And we happen to have used TRIP. This is the pathway for the synthesis of tryptophan. And if it has three steps, there are at least three enzymes. Now, how does feedback inhibition work? The end product, when it gets to be high, goes back, binds to the first enzyme in the pathway, and inhibits it. This symbol that I've used here is equivalent to the symbol on the handout with a minus. Since people have started drawing more and more complicated diagrams, they found this symbol, these are both symbols for inhibition. But this other one that I just introduced is a little easier to follow. Now, what gives here? You look at the little table on the bottom. We're talking about feedback inhibition. I'm going to draw it over here. You notice, what did we change? We changed the activity of one enzyme, how well it works. We didn't change the amount of any enzyme. We just changed how well each molecule of enzyme 1 works. So we changed activity of enzymes, not amount of enzyme. Now, how many enzymes did we affect? Notice only one. By slowing down enzyme 1, we slowed the flux through this pathway, and that was sufficient. We stopped making tryptophan. So we only affected one enzyme, namely the first. And this happens pretty fast. Because as soon as you have high tryptophan, it binds to the allosteric feedback inhibitory site on the enzyme and slows down the enzyme. Now, how does that compare with repression? So that's feedback inhibition. Repression actually affects the synthesis of the enzymes. So it affects how well the genes work. These are the genes for the three enzymes respectively. Feedback affects the pre-existing enzyme. Tryptophan, through repression, inhibits all three genes and cuts off more protein synthesis. As we will see later, what it does is to prevent transcription of all the genes. So the difference here is we don't change enzyme activity. What we change is enzyme synthesis. Or you could say gene activity, if you want to compare it that way. So we don't change the enzyme that's already there. We prevent the synthesis of new enzyme. Now, is this going to be as fast? This is going to be slower because you have to make the messenger RNA and translate it and fold up the enzyme. So this is a little slower. And it affects all the enzymes in the pathway. Now, why do you need both of these? These have been compared to the coarse control dial and the fine control dial. The feedback inhibition is sort of the fine control. You leave the enzyme that you have, but you diddle it a little bit. You make it work a little slower, you make it work a little faster, depending on whether it's inhibition activation. But repression is the coarse control. It shuts down the production of enzyme and changes the amount of enzyme. Now, why would you want to do that? Why not just keep making the enzyme and shut it down? What's wrong with that?
Too much energy.
Too much energy. It takes energy to make message and to make protein. So making stuff you don't need is a drag on the establishment. And apparently, cells have been selected for being more efficient. The more efficient cells that didn't waste energy when they didn't need to left more descendants and have taken over. So in bacteria, at least, there is strong selection for efficiency and not wasting energy. So, if we really need repression then, how does it work? We're going to focus today, actually, not on repression, but on induction. But as I said, they work sort of in the same basic way. So what we want to do now is look at the other side of your handout, at the basic setup here. issue here is how are we going to explain what is called coordinate control? In both induction and repression, it takes several enzymes to carry out some function. And either you make all of them or you make none of them. How do you turn on the synthesis or coordinate the synthesis so that when you make enzyme 1, you make enzyme 2, and you make enzyme 3? So either you make all three of them or you don't make any of them. Now, it turns out that when you check it out, all the genes, gene 1, gene 2, gene 3, that produce enzymes in the same pathway, those genes are located next to each other on the DNA. So on our left picture here, we've drawn the DNA. And here are the three genes. I've just picked three at random. And they're called S1, S2, and S3 because S stands for structural. These are the genes that code for proteins. They code for enzymes that act in a pathway. And to keep it simple, we have three genes, three enzymes, short pathway. So the genes here are linked. That is, they are located next to each other on the DNA. Now, how does that help? These three genes share a single promoter. Because there is a single promoter, that means we're going to start transcription at one end. And if we transcribe one gene, we're going to transcribe all three. Now, I haven't said it, but there has to be a terminator somewhere off on the far end. So this means you make a single message from this cluster. Now, this message now has the information in it to make three different peptides. And so this is called a polycistronic message. Cistron, it turns out to be another word for gene. So it means it's a polygene message. Now, what are we saying here is that what is controlled is the amount of message. If I make a lot of message, then that will get translated and I'll make a lot of all three proteins. If I make little or no message, then it won't get translated, of course, and I'll make little or nothing of all three proteins. So regulation here is at the level of transcription. This is an example of what people call transcriptional control. You control the production of message, and the rest takes care of itself. Now, why does this work? You may remember we said last time that messenger RNA has a relatively short half-life. So by controlling the synthesis of messenger RNA, you control what proteins will be made. At each moment, you make appropriate message, it gets translated, you make some of that protein, and then that message gets degraded. And if you need more of the same protein, you make more of the same message. If you need different proteins, you make a different message. In eukaryotes and in some prokaryotes, there is also regulation of translation and other steps. But in many cases in prokaryotes, as long as you control the message amount, you don't have to worry about the rest of it. The rest is more or less automatic. Whatever message is there gets translated. Now, that means that these three genes are being transcribed as a unit, and this whole unit is called an operon. And the operon refers to the structural genes that are transcribed as a unit plus the regulators that control that, such as the promoter. Now, let's think a minute about punctuation. There has to be a start signal for transcription around here somewhere and a stop signal for transcription around here. But where are the start and the stop signals for translation? Notice we're going to get three proteins out of here. So if we're going to get three proteins, where are we going to start translation? How are we going to get the first one? We're going to have to start translation over here somewhere. And remember we said that there's a 5' untranslated region. So the first AUG isn't at the very end. But wherever the first AUG is, we're going to start translating. The ribosomes are going to attach, and we're going to start chugging out protein. Now, where is there another start signal? There has to be a start signal to make each protein, and there has to be a corresponding stop codon to stop making each protein. So there have to be three start codons here and three stop codons. So the ribosome attaches, translates the first gene's worth, comes to a stop codon, and releases the first protein. Now, it can then start over again, the same ribosome, and make a second protein, or that ribosome can fall off, and another ribosome can attach at the beginning and make a second protein. Depends on the fine points. But the point is that the signals for translation are different from the signals for transcription. And of course, after the last stop codon here, there's a 3' untranslated region as well. Now, what we have here explains coordinate control, but it doesn't explain anything about how you turn it off. Notice what we have here is an operon that is, so to speak, on. It's transcribed, it's translated, and we get our proteins. How do you ever turn it off? That's what the second panel on the top is for. You have to add some more features that we left out the first time. So let's put in the same ones again. We still have our three structural genes, linked and transcribable as a single unit, and we have a promoter. But now we have another sequence of DNA which acts in a regulatory capacity. The promoter is a sequence of DNA to which RNA polymerase binds. We have another sequence called an operator. Now, this also is a sequence to which a protein binds. And the protein that binds to it is called the repressor protein, or just the repressor. And I've symbolized it by a little rectangle. Now, the idea is that if the repressor protein binds to the operator, that prevents RNA polymerase from attaching or proceeding. It prevents RNA polymerase from transcribing this operon. So once the repressor protein is in place, the operon is off. Where did the repressor protein come from? Where does any protein come from? You got to have some DNA, you got to code for some message, you got to translate it, etc. So somewhere on this DNA, there has to be a gene for the repressor protein. So I'm going to add it over here. And I'm just going to call it R. So you need something like, if you look at the third panel and the fourth panel, you see over there on the left, you're going to have to read this out, transcribe it to make a little RNA, and you're going to have to read the RNA to make with a ribosome to make a protein. And then that protein can go sit on the operator and shut everything off. So you have a switch here that has two parts. It has the DNA part, the operator, and it has the protein part, the repressor. And if they get it together, the operon is off. Now, there are many different operons in a cell. And each repressor protein, each operon, has its own repressor protein. So I brought here another model or two. This is a different representation of DNA. Again, it's a double helix. This is the sugar, phosphate, sugar, phosphate backbone. The sugars are red and the phosphates are gold and silver, yellow and silver. So you have the two backgrounds, which are anti-parallel, but that's not the point here. And then you have the base pairs. Now, this model makes it a little clearer that there's a groove on each side of the helix, and that proteins can bind to this helix. They either fit in a groove or they actually clamp on both sides. And because the sequence along this helix varies, you can have a protein that is sequence specific and only binds at certain areas. RNA polymerase only binds to certain areas. Those are called promoters. DNA polymerase only binds to certain areas. Those are called origins. Repressors only bind to their corresponding operator. So this might be a repressor protein. And it might fit in the groove, might fit like that, depending on the fine points. Now, if we have a different operon somewhere in the DNA, like we have the lac operon that controls the enzymes of lactose metabolism, then we have the trip operon that controls the enzymes of tryptophan synthetase. Each of those operons has its own operator, and it has its own repressor. So these repressors would be different, and they would bind to different spots on the DNA, so that one shuts off the trip operon, and one shuts off, appropriately, the lac operon. Now I have a question for you. I want to see if I want to say this first. Does the repressor protein, does the repressor gene have an operator, and does it in turn have a promoter? Does this gene, let's ask first, does this gene have a promoter? And also, does it have an operator? Now, the operator, I realize, part requires that you know something else. So let me explain something first, and then we'll come back and consider that question. The repressor protein is an allosteric protein. Because remember, we have to be able to turn operons on and off. In the case of induction, we have to be able to go from an off operon to an on operon. We add lactose and go that way. In a repressible operon, we have to do the reverse. We add tryptophan to an on operon, and it goes off. So how are you going to do that? And the trick to that is that the repressor protein is an allosteric protein. It has two forms, which I have diagrammed as a circle and a rectangle. Now, I've written that in that way because I want to imply that one form sticks to the operator and shuts down transcription. And the other form lies around and does nothing. You might say it rolls off the operator. So the trick is that the presence of the effector, here the inducer, say, lactose, determines whether the protein is in one form or the other. So we're saying that our repressor is an allosteric protein, and when it binds its small molecule like lactose, it changes shape a little bit. And now it either, in the case of lactose, how do you get induction? You can look now, if you want, at the third panel. which is written this way, I think. I want to be sure to match my picture. Yeah. So the idea is that the repressor protein has these two forms. When it binds lactose or inducer, it switches from rectangle, stick to the DNA, to circle, fall off the DNA. When you take the inducer away, it goes back to its rectangle form, sticks to the DNA, and shuts the operon off. So what we're saying is that in this case, the empty form is the rectangle. Sticks to the DNA, shuts everything off. Inducer comes along, binds to our protein, changes the shape of the repressor a little bit, falls off the DNA. So now, if the repressor is gone, we're in the on state. Now in picture 3, there's a repressor protein here, but it isn't doing anything. If we have an on operon, what's happening? We're transcribing the repressor gene. We're making repressor protein. But if this operon is on, where is the repressor protein? Is it on the operator? No. So in fact, it must be in the other form. It must be round. And that's what the presence of inducer does. Inducer shifts the balance or the equilibrium so that the repressor is in the round do-nothing form. When you take away inducer, you go back to the stick-to-the-DNA form. Now, there are a few more things I want to say about that, but first let's come back to the question I raised before. Now that we know something about the repressor protein, does the gene for repressor protein have a promoter or an operator? I want you to think about that for a minute and try it out on your neighbor and come to a conclusion, and then we'll take a vote. Does the repressor gene have a promoter? How many people say no? How many people say yes? Okay, now the opinion seems to be yes, but some people said no. If you don't have a promoter, can you transcribe the gene? And that's the catch. You always need a promoter for RNA polymerase to bind, to transcribe, to make RNA. So in fact, every transcribed gene has a promoter. So there has to be a promoter. Now, what about the operator? Let's ask first. Well, let's just think about it. How many people think it has an operator? A couple people. How many people think it doesn't? How many people are undecided? What determines it? Is this protein made all the time or not? Well, if we only made repressor protein when we needed to turn something off, who controls making the repressor protein? We've just pushed it one back. The beauty of this scheme is that the repressor protein is made all the time. So what determines if it's doing anything? It's that small molecule, the inducer. If the inducer is there, the repressor protein is in one shape. If the reducer is absent, the repressor is in the other shape. So the point here is that you make repressor protein all the time. Its synthesis is constitutive. The shape it's in varies, and that depends on the amount of inducer or effector. But you make it all the time. So if you make it all the time, do you need an operator? And now the answer is no. If something is produced constitutively, its gene needs no operator. The genius of this system is that you avoid the infinite regression problem. You don't have to control production of the repressor. You just have to control what state it's in. Now, I just want to say one more piece of this, of how this works, that may make some of it a little bit clearer. We're assuming here that you have an equilibrium between the stick to the DNA form of the repressor and the fall off the DNA form of the repressor. We're assuming that when you add inducer, you push this equilibrium to the right. When you remove inducer, you push the equilibrium to the left. So inducer determines which way it goes, whether you have mostly rectangle form or mostly circle form of repressor. How do you actually get the repressor off the DNA? The equilibrium really has three steps to it. There is always an equilibrium between bound and free rectangle repressor. So at any one moment, there's always a little loose rectangle repressor. Now, if inducer comes along, what will happen to the rectangle repressor? Inducer will combine with it, and we will get circle repressor. That will pull, that will reduce the concentration of free rectangle, and therefore more of it will fall off the induced, fall off the operator. So it's really a three-step equilibrium, and as you have more and more inducer, you pull it to the way I've drawn it down, you pull repressor off. When in the absence of inducer, the repressor goes back. So if we come back to our allosteric protein here, each repressor protein has to have two unique binding sites. It has to bind its effector, its inducer in this case, or co-repressor, has to be specific. We want this to respond to lactose and not to tryptophan. So it has to have a binding site for lactose. But what else does it have to bind? Has to stick to the DNA. It has to have a DNA binding site and an effector binding site. And the repressor of another operon has also those two sites, but two different ones. So now I have another question for you. What will happen if the repressor protein does not work? If it is either not made at all or totally ineffective? What will happen to this operon if the repressor protein doesn't work? I don't want you to call this one out. I want you to think about it for a minute. So one, what if the repressor is no good? Will this operon be in the permanently off state, the permanently on state, or something in between? Second of all, if you want a crummy repressor that doesn't work for sure, what's better, a missense mutation or a nonsense mutation in this gene? So try that. And if you finish that one, well, let's just do those two. So you get a few seconds, get a minute to try that one out and discuss it. What do you think? Thank you. Is this operon permanently off? Is it permanently on?
Yes,
it's permanently on. Because what happens if there's no repressor? Which state are we in? We're in that one. No repressor, just everything's on. So you need the repressor protein to turn things off. It turns out it's the same whether it's induction or repression, as we will see in this respect. But now, if you really want to be sure the repressor doesn't work, who votes for a missense mutation? Nonsense mutation. Can't decide. Okay, so if you can't decide, you should think about it, because a nonsense, remember, means a stop in the middle, means a short peptide, which almost never does what it's supposed to. All right, so if we knock out, so if we have a mutation here in our gene, and we knock out the repressor protein, what becomes constitutive? The synthesis of all three enzymes will become constitutive. These three enzymes will be made all the time, and you can't turn off their synthesis. So this is called a constitutive mutation. So I have a question for you. Is there any other spot on the DNA you can screw up and get synthesis to be constitutive? Suppose that the repressor gene is fine. No mutation. Can you put a mutation somewhere else that will make this operon constitutive? Don't say anything to me. Just talk to the person next to you and see if you can think of it. You get 30 seconds for this one. The DNA and get synthesis of all three enzymes to be constitutive? The operator. Notice that to turn this operon off, I need a switch with two halves. I have to let the repressor protein sit on the operator. If either half is screwed up and the match cannot be made, I cannot turn this operon off. So there are two kinds of constitutive, one in the operator and one in the gene for repressor protein. Now, how do you can actually tell them apart. How do you test out the properties of constitutive mutants? It turns out that this whole mechanism was figured out largely by testing the properties of constitutive mutants. What people did was to put together either two constitutives or a constitutive and a normal and see what happens. Now the problem is, how can a bacterium have two copies of something? The pictures of bacteria that we always draw show the bacterium looking like this. Here is the bacterium. Here is its genetic information. It has one chromosome, one circular DNA molecule. So if that's the way it looks, it only has one copy of everything. So how can you put in two? So this is something to which we will return. Well, I'm going to skip that part in the notes for now and come back to it either this time or next time. For now, all you have to do is take it for granted that it is possible to put into a single cell two copies of an operon. And one copy can be normal, one copy can be mutant, or they can both be mutant. And then you can see what the cell does. And from that, you can figure out a lot. Now, we haven't told you the results of these experiments. They are all in the problem set for you to try. And the fact that people got the Nobel Prize for figuring this out means that they're complicated, and you shouldn't get discouraged too easy. Now, before we leave the operons per se, I want to consider another aspect of this, We've talked a good bit about the operator, but what about the promoter part? What does it contribute to all of this? All promoters are not the same. Now, all promoters have certain properties in common. What is a promoter supposed to do? Has to bind RNA polymerase. It's the chair where RNA polymerase sits down and starts moving. So all promoters bind RNA polymerase, but their affinity for RNA polymerase varies. So all promoters have certain similarities of sequence, but they're not all exactly the same. And they can be weaker or stronger. People talk about weak promoters and strong promoters. Now, the idea is that a strong promoter has a strong affinity for RNA polymerase. RNA polymerase tends to settle in often and to transcribe often. So if you have a strong promoter, you will make many copies of the corresponding RNA, and you'll get a lot of the corresponding protein. A weak promoter is the opposite. A weak promoter has a weak affinity for RNA polymerase. It very seldom catches RNA polymerase. Polymerase doesn't sit down very often, but when it does, it transcribes. So if you have a weak promoter, you only get a few copies of the RNA. So you get lots of RNA. Or perhaps we should say, a strong promoter gives you a lot of transcription, weak promoters give you a little transcription. Now, you might think, who wants weak promoters? Now, who needs those sappy guys? But they actually have their uses. Let's go back and look at our operon here. Now, our operon consists of this entire unit. Notice that the promoter must be near the structural genes which it controls. The operator must be near the structural genes that it controls. So this whole unit, genes plus their operator and promoter, constitute an operon. But you also need the repressor gene to make the whole thing work. So when people talk about an operon, they usually include the repressor gene. Except that the repressor gene doesn't have to be located on the DNA right next to the others. Because the repressor gene makes a protein that can flow through the cell and act wherever it's needed. So all the other parts have to be right next to each other, but the repressor gene does not. So depending on context, the term operon does or doesn't include the repressor gene. Usually it does, because all of this works as a unit. Now, coming back and looking at our operon, consider the lac operon. If you want to metabolize lactose as a primary source of energy, how much beta-galactosidase do you need? A little or a lot? Probably a lot. If you're breaking down lactose for a living, you need quite a lot of the corresponding enzyme. And it turns out that the major promoter for the structural genes of the lac operon is a strong promoter. It binds RNA polymerase well. When the operon is on, you make a lot of message, and you make a lot of beta-galactosidase and other enzymes needed to metabolize lactose. But we have in this picture a gene that does not need a strong promoter. We have a protein in this picture that the cell only needs a few copies of. You only need a few copies, probably 100 or so, of the repressor protein. You need enough repressor protein so that there is enough so that that there is always one available to sit on the operator. Now, to keep this equilibrium pushed toward stick to the operator, you need more than one molecule of repressor. You probably need about 100 molecules of repressor to the cell, because remember, repressor is always coming on and off. So to be sure that there's always available molecule to sit and keep the operon off, you need more than one. But you don't need a lot. You don't need that many molecules of repressor per cell. Therefore, where do you want a weak promoter? Here. This one. So the promoter for the structural genes is a strong promoter, but the promoter for the repressor gene is a weak promoter. Now, what's the respective role here of the operator and the promoter? The operator is responsible for binding repressor protein. So the state of the operator, full, empty, etc., determines how much transcription you get. But suppose the repressor protein is out of the way. The operator is clear. How much RNA will you make? Who determines that? That's the promoter's job. So the promoter determines how much message you can make if the gene is going full blast. The operator-repressor combination determines what percent of full blast have you got. So the two work together to regulate the production of the corresponding message and the corresponding enzyme. Now, we have talked here about the idea that induction and repression work sort of the same way, as in fact they do. The main difference is that an inducer promotes converting the repressor to the fall-off form, and a co-repressor promotes converting the repressor to the stick-to form. But we have deliberately not talked a lot about repression. So what I want you to do, we don't have class again until next Thursday, courtesy of Election Day, and you should all please go vote. And so as a result, I want you to try and at least get some sense of how induction works. And then we'll come back at the beginning of class next time and compare induction-repression. Now, I'm not finishing. I just want to explain why I'm not talking about repression, because you can only absorb so much at once. So we're going to leave the details of the mechanism of repression, which is the bottom panel on your handout, and talk about a compare and contrast between induction and repression next time. And the problems that you've been assigned are to match this. So I want to spend the rest of the class talking about what is actually the official topic for today, which is how bacteria pass their DNA around. First, we want to consider how they do it with normal DNA, and then we want to consider this question that we raised earlier: how could a cell have two copies? So we want to go back to this picture. Except I'm going to redraw it. We have explained how a cell doubles its DNA, how the DNA is used to double the RNA and the protein, and how the protein is used to synthesize any small molecules you need and break down things for energy. So we understand how you could double the contents of a bacterial cell. And the question now is, if you had doubled the contents of a bacterial cell, how would you divide that up? Now, what has to be divided exactly? Suppose one daughter cell gets a few too extra ribosomes and one gets a few too many. Can you fix that? If you have normal genetic information, can you make ribosomes? Yeah, as long as you have at least one ribosome. So as long as you have some ribosomes and you have at least one set of transfer RNA, you can do whatever you need to do, and whatever you're missing, you can make. But there is one thing you have to get, besides one ribosome, of course, there is one thing that each daughter cell has to get exactly the right amount of. What's that? That's the DNA. If the DNA is doubled so that there are only two copies, then each daughter cell has to get one of them. It's not good if one daughter cell gets two and one daughter cell gets none. So they have to be divided exactly. Everything else you can sort of cut down the middle and it can be approximate. So the way the DNA is divided is you start with the picture I had over there. The DNA is double-stranded and it's attached to a point on the membrane. And what happens is that you have bidirectional replication from a single origin. So if this is the bacterial DNA, as we've explained before, you open it at one point in the middle, that's the origin of replication, and then you have one fork which goes around one side, and one fork which goes the other way, until eventually the forks will meet in the middle. Now what happens is that as the DNA is replicated, each daughter molecule is attached to the membrane. Each of these, the way my model is, each of course would have a partner, would have made the complement, but each new double strand would be half old, half new. Each double strand would be attached to the membrane. So the next picture by the time we have two complete double strands, each of them is attached to the membrane. Now what happens is the bacteria lay down new membrane material and new cell wall in the middle. So new material is laid down between the two of them, and the two attachment points with their DNA molecules are pushed further apart. So that eventually what you end up with is a double-sized cell, and one DNA molecule has been pushed to one end, and one DNA molecule has been pushed to the other, and the protein and the tRNA and all that stuff is about even Steven. And now the final step is to lay down a membrane and then a wall between them. And then you get two cells. Now, how do these two cells compare in terms of genetic information? How should they compare? They should be exactly the same, unless there's been a mutation. So if you start with one, and it doubles, and that doubles, and that doubles, and you get a bacterial colony, all these cells are descendants of a single starting cell, and barring mutation, they should all be the same. So this is called a clone. And if you start with one molecule and make many molecules, that's also called a clone. And if you start with one organism and you make many identical organisms, that's also called a clone. That's where the idea of cloning Dolly comes from. But in bacteria, that's usually the way it is. Bacteria do engage in sex, but it's somewhat different than human sex, as we will explain next time, in many ways. Now, we said that when you're analyzing mutations, you sometimes want a cell that has two copies of a particular operon. But these bacteria only have one copy of their genetic information. A cell that has one copy of everything is said to be haploid. Now, cells like your own have two copies of the genetic information because you got one copy from your mom and one copy from your dad. So your cells are said to be diploid. And we'll talk about the fine points next time. Bacteria can acquire small pieces of DNA from the outside. Remember transformation? We said that you can take DNA from a PS plus cell and add it to a PS minus cell, and the minus cell will take up the foreign DNA. Certain bacteria do this normally. Now, what about the extra DNA? Yeah, I'm just going to... There are two possibilities for the extra DNA. One possibility is that it's just a small piece. If DNA is released or isolated from a normal bacterium, it gets broken into pieces. So normally, if a little bit is added, it'll be a short piece. It will be equivalent to some section of the chromosome, but only one section of the chromosome. Now, what will happen to this added piece? This piece is a fragment. What is going to happen to that fragment? Normally, the fragment has no origin of DNA replication because, say, it came from here or from here or from here or from here or from here. Unless it just happened to come from here, it has no origin. So when this bacterium doubles its DNA, it will double its chromosome, but it won't double the fragment. So that would mean the fragment would get diluted out. It's worse than that, because if a molecule in a bacterium has free ends, it will be degraded by nucleases. So unless something else happens, this fragment will get lost. It will not be copied, and it will not be passed on to the descendants. It will be there only transiently. The only alternative, and this is what happened with the PS minus and the PS plus, is rarely the added piece replaces the equivalent internal piece. How that works, we will explain later. So if that happens, if the DNA fragment is integrated, then it replaces the original, and then it's copied and passed on. But there's another alternative. Sometimes the extra DNA the bacterium picks up is a small circular mini chromosome. These occur naturally and are also created in laboratories. And these little fragments, these little circles, almost always have their own origin of replication, and they are called plasmids. Now, unlike fragments, plasmids are there for the long haul. Because when the large circle is replicated, the little circle will be replicated too. And so copies of both will be passed on to the descendants. So extra genes that are on a plasmid are not there transiently. They will be passed on from generation to generation. Now suppose there's one copy of the operon, lac operon, here on the plasmid, and one copy of the lac operon on the chromosome. This cell is called a partial diploid. Because it is diploid or has two copies for one part of the chromosome. In this case, the lactose operon. Everything else is only there once. But the lac operon is there twice. In human sex, a person gets a complete copy from one parent and a complete copy from another parent. In bacterial sex, you get one copy from one parent and a little piece from the other one. So it's a different ballgame. But the point of bringing this up then is that extra genes on a plasmid can be passed on generation after generation, and you can look at the colonies that come from this and see what their properties are and figure out a good deal. And that's all in the problem set. Now we're going to stop here, and Dr. Chazen is here, and we're going to give back the exams. We have the exams from both classes, correct? But we're going to give out the ones from the morning class first. If there are any TAs here, please come up front and help us out.